Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, we hear from one Dominican sister who returns from visiting Iraqi refugees in Lebanon. And on the heels of a Vatican conference on women, we look at some signs of concern and hope for women in the Middle East. Some 3 million Iraqis are living in precarious conditions in countries throughout the Middle East and elsewhere, having fled war and terrible sectarian violence at home. At least 70,000 Iraqis have sought refuge in Lebanon, a country of only 4 million people. And though the nation is valiantly attempting to cope with the influx, it is suffering skyrocketing inflation, severe political instability, a wave of bombings and militant activity, and the after effects of a war with Israel in 2006. Sister Toni Harris, International Justice and Peace Coordinator for the Dominican Order, has recently returned from a fact-finding mission to Lebanon and Syria. She was part of a delegation of religious invited by Catholic Relief Services to meet Iraqi refugees and view their living conditions in order to advocate on their behalf when they returned home. Sister Toni says Middle Eastern countries like Syria, Jordan, and Lebanon are suffering the fallout of the U.S.-led war in Iraq and the lack of a strategy to pull the country back together. In Lebanon, Sister Toni saw entire Iraqi families living in squalid one- or two-room apartments, those lucky to find them. Others were among detainees in a big detention center in Beirut. Catholic charities like Caritas are doing their best to meet their needs, but, she says, it's not enough.
One of the first stops that we made in Beirut was with the Chaldean bishop, the Catholic. I mean, this is a rite of the church in union with Rome. These are our Catholic brothers and sisters, and this particular church is trying to respond to the Iraqi refugees because, of course, many of them are members of the Chaldean church, and maybe people came hoping that the church would be able to help them. You know, it's
would that be
know.
The first their first door that they knock on, the church?
I think for the Christians it probably is, and I mean, like many people who are desperate, certainly people learn to look for every possible resource and every possible help that might be available to them. But certainly I think the expectation that Christians have that somehow the rest of the Christian community couldn't possibly ignore them, I think that's part of the discouragement, is that even though the church is trying to help, you know, it's certainly not enough in the face of the number of people and the problem.
What is the answer? I mean, these people, they arrive in Beirut, they're living in underground or ground level shacks, small apartments all crowded into one small space. They don't have any source of income. Maybe they're even spending what little money that they brought with them from Iraq on rent. How are they surviving? And what is the answer?
Well, I think that what you're saying is absolutely true. This was described to us that, you know, the first wave of refugees from Iraq were people who had more resources. They were either wealthier people to begin with, and they could afford to leave and to take financial resources with them, and they were able to live on those resources for a while. And then the economic class, if you will, started to drop downwards. People who had fewer resources came, until finally very poor people came just trying to save their lives in the sectarian and violent kind of situation that's continued to develop in Iraq. So the solution is very hard to describe or to identify. When we think about the fact that there are 70,000 approximately, and again, how does anybody know these numbers? You know, they're very hard to determine. Some of the UN tries to do registration of people, and then that makes them eligible for some services, a box of food every 2 months or something like that. You know, they're able to get some services. But so the UN has numbers only of the registered people, which is a fraction of the number estimated in countries. So you've got 70,000 in Lebanon, perhaps 750,000 in Jordan, and the estimates in Syria were over 1.5 million. So we have, what, close to approaching 3 million people outside their country displaced, 2.5 million anyway. And then we have all the displaced people inside the country. And people that we talked to said, you know, if they're able to go back, they can't go back. Their homes aren't there. It's not like their house that they left is there waiting for them. Their houses have either been destroyed or taken over by other folks. So to go back requires, it seems to me, first of all, some kind of feeling of security. And people don't feel secure. If people go back, and even the acting ambassador, that's not actually his title, it's sort of agent in charge, in Syria, for the United States presence there, the mission there, said to the group, it's important that people don't think this problem is going away. This problem is not solved. Even if we think 10,000, which sounds like a lot of people, 10,000 people go back to Iraq, that's infinitesimally small percentage of the total number of people who are displaced and who are still in a refugee kind of situation, you know. So given the fact that these folks are Middle Eastern, it would be very nice if there were a way to integrate them in Middle Eastern countries, to have them be welcomed and be, I mean, they've certainly been welcomed, but to have them be legalized in some of the Middle Eastern countries would be great.
But however, most, I would imagine that most people are hoping beyond hope that they will be one day able to go back to their own country.
It would need a tremendous amount of change in the country that Iraq has become. Most of the people that we've talked to and other people that I've talked to who have lived in Iraq describe the country as very different than the country they grew up in. I mean, certainly you think people want to go back to their homeland. And it may be that if Sunni or Shia groups are in particular neighborhoods, people may, if they belong to those particular groups, they may feel safe going back to that neighborhood. But according to most Iraqis, that kind of distinction between Muslim groups and between Muslims and Christians was not dominant in anybody's mind before the U.S. invasion. And people lived as neighbors, lived next door to each other. People looked after each other, watched out for each other, worked with each other. Now, it's my understanding that many of the more moderate people in any group have fled if they could. And because of the lack of planning by the U.S. government and without any border controls, extremists have come to dominate the country. It's not the same country, I think, that people left. So to go back, you know, I mean, to go back to what, in a sense, is their question, I think. Certainly people like to be at home and where their families are and where they grew up. That's certainly most of our first choice, but
you were saying that you thought a just solution to the refugee problem would be for the Arab countries to absorb many of these Iraqi refugees, give them citizenship or at least rights to have a job and have access to health care and schools and so on. What do you think about the U.S.'s policy on accepting Iraqi refugees?
Well, I don't mean to be interpreted to think that or to say that the whole responsibility is the Arab countries. The Arab countries, it seems to me, in the vicinity of Iraq have been doing a remarkable good deed, if you will, to try to absorb this Arab brothers and sisters, sort of this pan-Arab kind of identity in the country. When you think of the fact that Syria, which is a state about the size of North Dakota in the United States, with 19 million people or so, has absorbed 1.5 8 million, possibly, refugees, and now is suffering tremendous inflation, tremendous real estate escalation, all these problems, but are still trying to be hospitable, for the most part, to refugees. It's an amazing example. I don't know that the Arab states can be expected to do all of the absorbing. The problem is removing people from the Middle East who basically want to be in the Middle East, I think, and who have their roots and connections there. But certainly the United States and I think the other countries that were part of the coalition and other countries that may have just the goodwill to try to help with this human crisis need to accept more refugees for resettlement in other countries. We learned in both Lebanon and Syria that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has prepared and has screened, I think they told us, a total of about 13 or 14,000 refugees who are screened already, waiting, according to the requirements that the United States gave the UN High Commissioner. And now it's up to the United States to do, I think it's two more rounds of processing people to try to identify the 12,000 that the U.S. is willing to take. So, unfortunately, it seems like some people in the U.S. are trying to say the UN isn't working fast enough to get refugees screened for us to do the next screening. But that was not the case in terms of what we observed. The UN has people screened according to U.S. criteria, and now the Homeland Security need to screen people so that at least 12,000 people can be placed in the United States. So I think especially the countries, primarily the U.S., that created this problem have got to face the responsibility of absorbing some of these almost 3 million people that have had to flee their country because of the violence and either the initial violence or the violence that's resulted because of the chaos and lack of planning for a stable government in the country.
Sister Toni Harris is International Justice and Peace Coordinator for the Dominican Order. The social and religious rights of women in the Middle East was a topic of discussion at an International Vatican Conference in February. Organized by the Pontifical Council for the Laity, the conference, entitled Woman and Man, Humanity in its Entirety, was called in celebration of the 20th anniversary of the publication of Pope John Paul's apostolic letter to women, Mulieris Dignitatum. The conference looked at various aspects of the role of women in society and in the church from historic to modern times in various regions of the world. Well, Lebanese Father George Haddad addressed the 260 participants, summarizing his experience as a parish priest in Kuwait for 10 years and his perception of the life of women in the Gulf and other countries in the Middle East. He is author of an Italian book taking an in-depth look at the rights, freedoms, and dignity of women in the region. Women enjoy greater independence, he says, in more moderate Middle Eastern nations like Lebanon, Jordan, and Syria than they do in conservative Islamic states like Saudi Arabia and even Kuwait, which have hundreds of thousands of Christian immigrants working within their territories.
When I was in Kuwait, I saw the women, how they live, what they can do, what they cannot do. So I wrote a thesis about the woman in the Bible, in the Quran, and the woman in the Middle East, in the Muslim cultures and in the Christian cultures, in Orient and in the Occidental countries. In the book, you can see the differences between the woman in the Middle East, the woman in the Gulf, in confront with the woman in Europe.
Now, in Kuwait, you mentioned that that's where you got the idea first for this book. Of course, that's a predominantly Muslim culture. It's a wealthy nation. However, I would imagine that many of the Christians living there are immigrants, people who have come to find jobs, mostly from the Philippines and other areas of the world. How did you see these two communities interact? Women from the immigrant Christian communities and the Muslim women in Kuwait?
In Kuwait, when I was there between 1991 and 2000, I saw Muslim women. They cannot do a job, they cannot go out without their husband or their brothers or their son. So they cannot do what every woman can do in Europe or in our area, this area.
But did you get a feeling that the Muslim women there were frustrated with this, what we would say was a lack of freedom?
Not yet. In some areas they have some freedom, but in other areas, when the fundamentalism culture dominates, they don't have a freedom. They cannot do the job, they cannot go out. In Kuwait also you have everything is separate, like in the Gulf countries. You have, for example, a buses for the women, hospitals for the women, only for the women, and you have the schools for the girls, only girls. So everything is separated between women and men. It will be very, very difficult to change this mentality. There is some changes. For example, in other countries, you have the Muslims, they are open in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt. In some countries, you can see a big change. But there are very small changes in other countries, like the Gulf, or, for example, in Iran, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan. There is a small change, or there is no change.
What do you see these changes due to? There's frustration with the Middle Eastern governments. There's the war in Iraq. Are these things contributing to a general frustration that is leading to fundamentalism?
Yes, I think the frustration, they are not coming from the government in this area, in the Middle East, but in every country, you have groups or of fundamentalism, and the groups they don't want any change for the women, and they refuse any progress. They don't want the progress like in Europe or like in Occident.
What are they afraid of? Or is it not a question of fear? Is it something that just is directly related to their beliefs and what they read in the Quran?
Yes. The fundamentalism, they are afraid from the progress of Europe, of the West. So they are afraid of this progress. They don't want the progress comes to their area, to the Middle East or to the Gulf or to the other areas of Asia.
Is that your greatest concern right now for women, especially in the Middle East, this rise in fundamentalism?
No, because the fundamentalism, they don't want any change. They don't consider the woman outside of their house. The woman is respected only in the house, like mother or like wife or like daughter, yes. But not like women who go out for a job in the society.
And do you see a fundamental difference with women enjoying more rights in a Sunni or in a Shiite community?
You have two fundamentalism, the Sunni fundamentalism and the Shia fundamentalism. But I think the Sunni fundamentalism, Al-Qaeda, are more dangerous than Shia's fundamentalism.
How so?
Because
one is militant, the other isn't?
Yes, one Al-Qaeda, there are militants, there are against all the West, everything coming from the West, everything coming from America, United States, from Europe, from they refuse anything. But the fundamentalism of Shias in Iran, for example, I think they are not against the West, the progress of the West, but they are only against Israel.
How do women that you've met and talked to in the Middle East, Christian women, how do they feel living in a predominantly Muslim society?
They are always afraid from, not from Muslim society, they live not very well, but they live well, especially in Syria, Lebanon, Jordan. They live in this area well, but they are afraid from not the Muslim, but they are afraid from the fundamentalism, for the groups who are in this area, in this nation. But I think the problem is the minority of the Christian who lives in the Gulf. In Saudi Arabia, for example, they don't have any church. So there are around 1 million Christian who live and work in Saudi Arabia, so they don't have any church. They are always afraid from the fundamentalism. There you have many fundamentalism, and you have a minority of Christian.
In early February, the UN Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women urged Saudi Arabia to amend legislation to conform to an international women's rights treaty signed by the kingdom in the year 2000. Lydia O'Kane reports.
The committee's 23 independent experts called on Riyadh to take immediate steps to end the practice of male guardianship over women and work to eliminate what they described as negative cultural practices and stereotypes that discriminate against women. The committee said the kingdom's system of male guardianship restricts women's legal rights in marriage, divorce, child custody, inheritance, property ownership, and decision-making in the family, as well as choice of residency, education, and jobs. The British journal The Economist points the finger at the country's lack of laws forbidding violence against women and highlights the case last year of a victim of gang rape who was herself convicted to 6 months in prison and 200 lashes. The woman was eventually pardoned after stinging international outrage. The picture, though, may not be quite so black. The journal notes positive changes may well be in the offing. The government has given initial approval for the establishment of the first Saudi women's rights organisation, and some signs indicate a ban on women driving may be lifted this year. Though Arab girls generally receive a quarter less instruction than boys, education for women in the Middle East is improving. Half of university students in Saudi Arabia are women, and even more women are enrolled in Kuwait and Qatar. And women are allowed to vote in some polls in every Arab country except Saudi Arabia. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
Basima Saman collaborates with the Latin Patriarchate, the Catholic Church, in Jordan. Basima says the Christian view of the rights and freedoms of women is not shared in many countries in the Middle East. And she notes that even in her native Jordan, a Christian woman is forced to renounce her faith and many of her rights if she marries a Muslim.
There is an inferiority view of women in the Middle East.
So women are seen as inferior?
Seen as inferior, yes. Second class. We are influenced by other culture, which is Muslim. Muslim cultures and mentality affects our life, our way of practicing our professions and these things. But we have religious freedom to practice our traditions and customs and way of praying in our buildings, churches. But we don't have a freedom in choosing religion. Like if there is someone to exchange his religion from Muslim to Christian or Christian to Muslim, it's not allowed.
Who doesn't allow it?
Of course, the society, the government, not allowed at all. And there is a problem in Jordan, mixed marriages. When Christian girl marries a Muslim boy, she will lose her legal rights, Jordanian legal rights. She will lose her ecclesiastical rights in church also.
So she won't be able to continue being Christian?
Yeah, because she will be forced to change her religion to make this marriage happen. If she didn't change, she will lose her inheritance from her husband or lose her the custody of her children if there is divorce happen, this marriage or, you know, or difficulties or anything. So the state will be beside the Muslim, not the Christian. There is a difference between us, yes. But I want everyone to accept the other, to love each other, to accept being there as a Christian, as it is there is Muslim and there is a Christian people. To be open to each other, to understand our beliefs, values, and the differences between us, to respect them. This is our rights as a human beings.
An expert Mideast observer, Franciscan Father David Yeager, wrote the foreword to Dr. Haddad's book on women in the region.
An interreligious marriage, marriage with disparity of worship between a Christian woman and a Muslim man, is not a realistic possibility in the Middle East. It is possible, but at the expense of the woman's own rights, of the integrity of her conscience, and at the expense and at the risk of the children. Because under the Islamic dispensation, generally children follow the religion of the father. And generally, in most societies in the Middle East, the woman would have to submit to the will of the father. So the conditions do not exist that the church prescribes for permitting marriage to an unbaptized person. Those conditions may well exist for such marriages in the West, in certain situations, and according to the judgment of the local hierarchies.
Father Yeager says a lot more has to be done before women can enjoy similar rights to men in the Middle East, and that the church can help lead the way.
I am very concerned that the church in the Middle East be in the forefront of the drive for women's rights, women's equality. In the West, to some extent, we let others show the way and caught up rather late, perhaps, in certain parts of the West. And I think that because of the deep roots of women's equality and women's rights, precisely in the Christian view of the world, the church should lead the way.
And that was Franciscan Father David Yeager, a longtime Middle East observer. Earlier, you heard Lebanese Father Georges Haddad, author of an Italian book, taking an in-depth look at the rights and freedoms of women in the Middle East. And also, Basima Saman, a collaborator with the Latin Patriarchate in Jordan. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.